It's good to have you with us. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and also crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch cites instances of Israel's apartheid policies as restrictions on the Palestinians' movement and the seizure of their land for illegal settlement building. The rights group has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of Palestinians. The court has said it will investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Before that, let's get an update from Mona Candila Romela about the situation in the occupied lands and also the Palestinians' exposure to Israel's crimes of apartheid. Mona, over to you.
Well, the Palestinians welcomed the Human Rights report on Israeli crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. It urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the Israeli officials implicated in the crimes against the humanity of apartheid. It also said that this Human Rights Watch report is considered as a powerful testament to the struggle of the Palestinian people under the Israel's belligerent military occupation. But at the same time, the Israelis considered this report as claims of both perspicuous as well as false. Israeli foreign minister accused the Human Rights Watch of harboring an anti-Israeli agenda, saying that the group had sought for years to promote a boycott against Israel. Now, the Palestinians are hoping that this report would be helping them to sue Israel for the crimes, not just officials, but also Israeli settlers for the crimes against the people of Palestine.
Okay, thank you for that. Mona Candila, correspondent in Ramallah. Now, let me invite activist and commentator Brian Turow from Malloy. Good to have you with us. Brian, some argue that Tel Aviv is taking advantage of apartheid to subjugate the Palestinians. Now, do you agree that Israel is practicing apartheid by sweeping movement restrictions of Palestinians, demolishing their homes, denying them building permits, military occupation, land expropriation, and also rejection of the residency rights?
Well, of course, yes. And I think the issue that I take with the Human Rights Watch is that they have said recently that Israel has crossed the threshold to where these have become crimes. And I believe that's happened a long time ago, decades ago. In 2006, former President Jimmy Carter recognized that Israel was an apartheid state and got great approbation for that. So this is a long-standing thing, and it's the difference is not that Israel has somehow crossed a line, a threshold, and become an apartheid state. This is the reality that people, Palestinian people, have lived in a state of apartheid for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we also have Mick Napier joining us out of Edinburgh. Good to have you with us, Mick. Israeli rights group B'Tselem also published a report last January, and in that it found that the Palestinians that are divided into four tiers of inferior treatment are denied the right to self-determination. Let's have your take.
Well, the report from Human Rights Watch is extremely welcome. It'll certainly shift the balance for those of us who are campaigning for the boycott of Israel. It'll shift the balance inside trade unions and church groups and mosque groups and so on, because it'll give those who are a little bit intimidated by the current Zionist censorship effort, it'll give them confidence and make it more likely that they will come out in support of boycott. Look, this is late, but it's very welcome. It's a little bit like admitting that the sun does indeed rise in the east and sets in the west. It's not the first. I mean, back in 2017, I'm sorry I missed the very first part of this conversation. Correct me if I'm repeating something. But back in 2017, Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley, on behalf of the United Nations body representing Western Europe, what people in Europe call the Middle East, came out with a report, a very comprehensive academic report, which was never challenged. The content of it was irrefutable. and it concluded that Israel was an apartheid state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, and it was suppressed by Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN. But the content was never challenged, because how can you challenge the assertion that Israel's an apartheid state when, for Palestinians, the so-called legal system is a meat processing operation where Palestinians are always guilty. Correction, 99.7% of the time they're found guilty by Israeli courts, and Jewish settlers are treated in a radically different manner by the court system. So dual legal system, Palestinian villages being unrecognized by the state, even though those villages are older than the state. I mean, when you look, if you have open eyes, you will conclude that Israel is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians. It's irrefutable. I mean, I doubt very much, sir, that you'll be able to arrange a debate, because I don't see anybody coming onto a public platform and defending the proposition that Israel is not an apartheid state. They'll blare it very loudly from their media, but they cannot defend it in an open platform. And by the way, I hear that not just B'Tselem in Israel, not just Human Rights Watch, but I hear that Amnesty International will shortly follow with the same conclusion. And I think I can hear the sound of a dam breaking. Those of us who have campaigned for decades in arguing that Israel was an apartheid state, indeed, is committing a kind of slow-motion genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, we see public opinion only going one way. And we distinguish between public opinion, which is very receptive to this idea, there's no opposition, and elite and government opinions in the West, which are still trying to, still trying to keep their finger in the dike before it bursts. But burst it will, and the Human Rights Watch report is a roadmap on the way. Can I add one other point that's often lost?
Sure.
But very recently, everybody saw the legal decision, or sorry, the jury decision in the USA about George Floyd being murdered by the cop, Mr. Chauvin. That verdict was very likely not to have happened without the activity of millions of people in America and around the world campaigning and protesting and arguing that Black Lives Matter. It's the Palestinians who really deserve the credit for this Human Rights Watch decision. It's very slow, it's very late, but it's Palestinian resistance which has changed the mood around the world. And although they can't win against Israeli weapons, they have won the battle for public opinion.
Okay. And now let me ask Brian this. Brian, isn't high time that international engagement toward applying international law and human rights change goalposts rather than considering the two-state solution as sacrosanct?
Yes, it's time that the apartheid state be looked at by the international community. It's time for Israel's nuclear weapons policy that has been off limits to speak about as well, as much taboo as apartheid. These all need to be spoken of. And it is the people, the Palestinians in the streets and the villages who have brought this about. And talk never brings justice all by itself. But we do have to begin speaking about things and calling things by their names before is an essential part of the work for justice. There's much reparation that needs to be done.
Okay, now, Mick, as an occupying force, Tel Aviv has certain responsibilities as regards the Palestinians. The regime not only ignores those functions, it also imposes fishing zone restrictions, making life harder for Palestinian fishermen in Gaza. It puts the Palestinian people's lives in further danger of the COVID pandemic, not to mention the administrative detention and you name it. Let's have your comment.
We don't have time, sir, to go through the list of crimes. We can do an A to Z. We can list the crimes against archaeology, where Israel removes any evidence when it possibly can that Palestinians have been the native people there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we can go to Z if we wish. The crimes are inevitable given that Israel is a settler colonial project? I mean, there are harsh regimes around the world. There are murderous dictatorships in Latin America and Myanmar and elsewhere. But very few of them actually wish to remove all of the native people and replace them with incoming colonists from around the world. That's one of the ways in which Israel is unique. And it goes with the territory that you cannot achieve this by soft-soaping the Palestinians, by asking them to leave. It just can't be done except with cruelty, violence, bureaucratic means to make sure they cannot have homes that they need for their families, demolition, shoot to kill, etc., etc. It's A to Z, and, you know, it cannot be ended unless Zionism is ended. This pernicious creed that some people claim a real estate deal with God from 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and therefore this means that Palestinians have to be driven out of their homes. It's a whole picture, and Israel well knows that it will incur condemnation. The PA Prime Minister Shtayyeh has condemned Israel. Could he do otherwise? And probably the EU will follow suit when they see bodies and torture and so on. But this condemnation doesn't mean anything, because as long as the air bridge of weapons and money from Washington and Brussels, it has to be said, to Tel Aviv continues, they know that they can defy world opinion. But yes, the criminality is undeniable. And as I said earlier, the pro-Israel groups will not try to defend this on a level playing field, because it is simply undeniable that Israel is committing grotesque crimes against the people of Palestine. Sadly, my government is arming the criminals.
Brian, would the International Criminal Court be able to run its own investigation in an independent and appropriate way and bring Tel Aviv to justice for all the crimes it's committed?
It will have a lot of obstacles. I don't think the Israeli government is going to be compliant and participate in this, just as the United States has not been compliant about our crimes in Afghanistan and other places. We are bringing sanctions, actually, against the ICC when they threaten to prosecute Americans. So I think we're going to see that same thing. I think the issue about apartheid, though, is very different from even having the longest list of discrete crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, this is systemic. It's institutional.
Right.
This is ensconced in the laws of Israel and in their education. In their economics, it's in their, you know, it's when you say it's an apartheid state, you're not talking about the prejudices and the bigotry and the cruelty of individual people, of thugs doing violence in the street, even though that's a part of it. And Haaretz newspaper yesterday said that the right-wing Jerusalem thugs are an arm of the state. It's the privatization of state violence in the streets. But we're not talking about individual crimes. We're talking about an entire system is imbued with racism.
Mm-hmm. And Mick, what do you think about the ICC? How effective could it be? I mean, if it starts an investigation, even if it's not able maybe to actually bring the perpetrators of the Tel Aviv regime to justice, could it in a way kind of contribute to the Palestinian cause?
I agree very much with your other guest. The ICC will investigate, hopefully, discrete crimes. Even the massacre of 1,000 people is some kind of individual, you know, some kind of discrete crime. The shooting dead, the mass maiming, and so on. These are a litany, but of all sorts of crimes. The thing about apartheid is, I mean, it's defined. Forgive me if I've missed this at the start. It's defined by the 2002 Rome Statute of the ICC as similar to other crimes against humanity. It's considered to be a crime against humanity. Now that means that we now begin to consider Israel, and we have to shift the discourse. Israel is not a place of multiple crime scenes, crimes here, crimes there, and so on. Israel is a crime scene, and the crime is apartheid. It's as B'Tselem says, a system of Jewish supremacy over non-Jews. And the proof is indisputable. We now need to carry this argument into civil society around the world. But this decision and this characterization of Israel as an apartheid state will drive the Zionists absolutely crazy, because it definitely shifts the playing field in the direction of the Palestinian people and their supporters around the world. And condemnation of Israel clearly gets you nowhere. It can only be people who are prepared to take action, and that would mean the first governments to begin to implement sanctions against Israel, to tell the ambassadors to leave or to reduce their diplomatic presence there, because it's a lawless, it is a crime scene. And the question of the brutality and the heroism of the Palestinians, but the brutality of the settlers and the police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, fits into this, because they're two arms in the same body. The notion that Israel's a democracy and the official state purveyors of violence will in some way rein in and control Jewish settlers, who are committed, by the way, not just to driving out all Palestinians, but to taking over the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well, destroying it and replacing it with a so-called Third Temple. The idea that these are two different bodies, Israel's a democracy, you cannot be a democracy and an apartheid state. And the sinister division of labour between the settlers, being protected by the military, is part of that. Can I just share one thing which has really concerned me for the last 20 years since I saw it in Jerusalem? I can't understand, but it's very telling. You see groups of Jews wandering around East Jerusalem with automatic rifles slung over their shoulders. They're not wearing uniforms. They're dressed probably like me or like you. Mm-hmm. But in some mysterious way, the soldiers know that these are armed Jews and they can move around freely. A Palestinian who might look very similar, if he or she carried a screwdriver, they would be shot dead instantly. But so this apartheid system, this armed groups of Jews terrorizing Palestinians, is so organic. It's right. Built into the system.
Now, Brian, there are also some outside players in this. Let's now focus on Washington-sponsored normalization deals among a number of Arab states and Tel Aviv, and also the so-called deal of the century and the way that they have impacted the Palestinians.
Well, yeah, of course, Washington, the arming of Israel and coming back the other way, United States police officers being trained by Israeli police and soldiers, the relationship is very close to the point where I feel as an American I'm as responsible for what's going on there as any Israeli, and feel compelled to take action on that. Yes, and the deal of the century, money and weapons can buy a lot, and these connections that are, my heart is not warmed by the United States brokering deals between Bahrain and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Israel and UAE and Israel. This is not does not bode well for the Palestinian people, and it's not really. It's been called this deal of the century has been called a peace deal, but it really is. It's an armaments deal. It's a deal among gangsters to make sure, as in the words of the Raytheon CEO. Peace doesn't break out in the Middle East anytime soon. To keep it an area of growth for U.S. weapons manufacturers.
Okay. Now, Mick, I got one last question. What's behind the inaction on the part of the European claimants of human rights and international law? Are Palestinians not human beings?
Of course not. Of course not. The legislation, the international law that was passed after World War II in Nuremberg and so on, was horrified at the crimes of the Nazis against Europeans. But those crimes have been committed against Africans and Asians and Americans for hundreds and hundreds of years. They were not supposed to apply to colonial peoples opposing colonialism. And that's the reality of the situation. My own government, in fact the Prime Minister Cameron, after the massacre of 2014, thousands of Palestinians slaughtered, he said, this proves how Britain has to stand behind Israel and defend Israel's security. Why is Israel part of the Eurovision Song Contest, part of the European Football League? It is a part of Europe in the sense of a colonial projection of Europe into the Middle East, and it enjoys the support of all the big players in Europe and certainly North America as an armed, as a substitute double aircraft carrier to chastise any governments that America feels is not being sufficiently obedient. Saudis know that, the Emiratis know that, and they've chosen to align themselves with America, and therefore to do that you must throw the Palestinians under the bus. But the Palestinians are winning in a very important field, and this Human Rights Watch decision is really a tribute to their resistance, their indomitability.
Okay, and I think we come to the end of this debate show. We had from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Nick Napier out of Edinburgh, and activist and commentator Brian Terror from Malloy, Indianapolis.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here. Today's lesson: focus and synchronization of prayers and actions. Brothers and sisters, in the blessed and holy month of Ramadan, we all tend to pray more, we all tend to supplicate more. But the question is, are our supplications and our actions in line with each other? Is our state of heart and our du'as and supplications in sync with each other? Are the feelings that we have inside us, the focus of our mind, in sync and in coherence with the words we utter in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? This is a question we all need to ask ourselves. Unfortunately, many a times we do not fulfill the required prerequisites to be in the court of Allah. That is the way it is. We stand in prayer in the state of ignorance and negligence, uttering words with the tip of our tongue while continuously thinking about our worldly affairs from the bottom of our hearts. But as regards to what is he going to do with us and our disobedience with this false supplication and negligence is described in one of the narrations where the Imam points out, in the first day prayer of the month as follows. The Imam says, he does not question us for being disobedient, does not expose us, covers up our faults, makes our good deeds apparent, does not deprive us from his blessings and favors, does not hand us over to others, closes his eyes from our faults, does not close the gate of repentance for us, encourages us to offer repentance for the second time and many times more, promises us acceptance and rewards, treats us the same way as he treats his pious, righteous servants, prevents us prevents others from insulting and exposing us and becomes angry upon them if they admonish us, does not turn off his affectionate and kind eyes from us, and does not like to see us in the state of degradation. Brothers and sisters, pause and ponder. When you recite this prayer of the first day of the holy month, uttering these sentences, what state of heart do you have?
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about our heart and mind and body and soul and actions being in synchronization and in that synchronized mode with our supplications in the blessed month of Ramadan. It is very important to be focused when we are praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Do you keep a little bit of it within your heart, whatever is being uttered? Is the question you should be asking yourself. When you supplicate to Allah, take a moment to read the translation and try to think about those concepts discussed in those translations. If you understand Arabic, great. If you don't, translations can be helpful. Even if they're not precise, even if they're not 100%, you can still refer to them to get an idea of what you're about to say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you read that, try to have this state of heart, this condition of your soul and spirit and mind in coherence and in synchronization with those words you're about to utter. This is how you get the full benefit of those du'as. If your actions are in line with those supplications, Allah definitely is going to be more merciful to you. He's going to grant you with a lot more out of these du'as, rather than you just reciting something that you don't even understand the meaning of.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But you know that there will be better, there will be stronger.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakhdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello and welcome to our program. Previously we talked about kafara or atonement, and then after that we talked about the notion of compensating for the fast that you had excuse for them, you could not have them. I'm going to talk more about the notion of qada, which we talked about before. There is a time for it. It means that, for example, imagine a person has not been able to fast for 5 days in the month of Ramadan. So after the month of Ramadan, that person should fast for 5 days, all right? Now, the time for it is up to the next year. It means up to the next Ramadan that comes in the next year. So you have 1 year time to have all of the fasts that you kind of broke in month of Ramadan, which passed, all right? So if after 1 year you neglect it, you don't pay attention to it, you ignore it, the other Ramadan comes, and not only you need to compensate for the fasts that you broke, but also you need to atone for them again. Now, atonement for this is easier. It is giving food that amount that we talked about, 750 grams of food, to a poor person, all right, for every fast that you could not have in month of Ramadan, which was passed. So there is a time for it. 1 year you have time to have your fasts. If after a year you don't do the fast without any excuse, without any acceptable excuse, then it means you need to atone for it too. Now, if a couple of years are going to pass, for example, a person has 5 fasts, all right? So after the month of Ramadan, that person should start. But 3 or 4 years they come to pass, okay? After the 4 years, 4 atonements we should do? No. The atonement is only once. So for one time, you need to atone for it. For example, 5 fasts, it means you need to give food to 5 people, 5 poor people, and make them full. And lastly to say is the fact that it happens a lot for some people. They doubt how many days they could not be able to fast. All right. For example, let me make it clear in this example. Imagine that a person before the month of Ramadan has gone on a trip and has come back 5 or 6 days in month of Ramadan. All right. So, for example, this is the 5th or 6th of Ramadan that person has come back. Now, when you ask him how many fasts you are not able to make, they say, "We are not sure. I'm not sure. Was it the 5th day of Ramadan, or was it the 6th day, for example, or was it the 7th day of Ramadan?" So they are not sure how many compensations they need to do. In this case, if you don't know when your excuse started, then you need to go for the most. Means you need to compensate the most number, like 7 here. So you need to fast for 7 days after the month of Ramadan. But sometimes you don't know when your excuse ended. For example, somebody has gone in the month of Ramadan on a trip and comes back at the end of the Ramadan, for example, 27th day of Ramadan or 28th day of Ramadan, right? So when you ask them, they are in confusion. They don't know. For example, he says, "I don't know, was it the 27th day that I came back, or was it the 28th day?" So in this case, the lower number should be followed, and the compensation would be less at the end. So there's a difference between when your excuse has started or when the excuse has ended. If it's started, you need to be careful, you need to be more cautious. The bigger number means more fasts should be made at the after the month of Ramadan. Or when we're talking about the time of the excuse when it ends, the lower number should be followed. Thank you so very much, and goodbye.
Around the World with Reporters.
For the fifth consecutive day, India has recorded an overwhelming number of COVID-19 infections. The country lodged around 350,000 fresh cases and about 2,700 deaths, raising fears of further devastation and dismay among its citizens. Many experts say the numbers are underestimations and that the real figures are likely to be much higher than the government figures. By Sunday, the number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation stood at 17 million with over 192,000 deaths.
India is witnessing scenes of utter mayhem amid new wave of the outbreak. The hospitals have been overwhelmed and are turning away patients due to lack of beds and oxygen supplies, revealing the vulnerability of India's healthcare system.
Many Indian states have now imposed more stringent restrictions on people's movement. Here in the capital, New Delhi, the lockdown has been extended for one more week as the cases are soaring rapidly. According to some estimations, more than 300 people are infected with COVID-19 every minute across the country. A few months ago, India seemed to be doing remarkably well in handling the COVID crisis, but experts say election campaigns, gatherings, and opening up of markets and public spaces aggravated the situation.
What we see on the TV about government data on deaths or infection is nothing but just a glimpse of actual numbers. Many cases are not even being reported, nor the calculations are accurate. This is not a pandemic. This is the sign of the judgment day. We don't even have a calculation of how many we cremate each day.
In his latest radio telecast, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged the nation not to fall prey to rumors and assured that the free vaccination program will continue in full swing. Indian leaders said this storm has shaken the country. Leaders from across the globe have expressed their concern and extended support in every possible way. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Senior officials from all signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are in the Austrian capital, Vienna, discussing ways to revive the ailing accord. 3 weeks on, there's no tangible progress in the discussions. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, said if Iran feels the other parties are trying to buy time, Tehran will leave the talks.
We are not here to waste our time. We are not here to negotiate for negotiations. We are here to specify and identify the sanctions which should be lifted by the U.S.
In his weekly briefing, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said there will be no agreement without an all-inclusive agreement.
We are not interested in lengthy talks, but we are also not in rush. The only principle that we are following is to fulfill all the benefits that Iran is supposed to get out of the JCPOA. Anything less than a wholesale, verifiable, and a single step removal of all sanctions is not accepted by Tehran.
The Vienna talks have so far failed to lead to concrete results. The major sticking point is the fact that the U.S. insists on pushing its own narrative, pressing for a step-for-step removal of the sanctions. Tehran has categorically rejected such a plan in the first place, saying Washington needs to verifiably remove all sanctions before Iran returns to full compliance.
All the sanctions, including those who have been imposed, reimposed, or relabeled, should be removed. The domestic politics of the United States is not our concern. In international relations and international law, governments are sole responsible bodies to fulfill the commitments of the states when they make.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. As a tit-for-tat, Iran reduced its own commitments by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, above the 3.6% cap set by the deal. As the Vienna discussions are becoming sluggish, Tehran says there's no need for prolonged negotiations. Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must lift all anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Period. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Many are artists across the world have turned to art to show the suffering of the Palestinian people. They use art as a medium of expression against the Israeli regime's repressive policies. Iran's Art Bureau of the Islamic Ideology Dissemination Organization is currently holding an exhibition and competition called Palestine is Not Alone. Hundreds of works by different artists from many countries are displayed at this international cartoon and poster contest, which is held to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We received around 2,500 works from 66 countries. Salient figures sent cartoons, caricatures, and posters to participate in the contest. It shows that there are many artists across the globe who want to support the oppressed people of Palestine and stand against the oppressor.
Today's war has a new form. It is more staged in the media. Art as a medium is now playing an important role in wars. There are many people who do not want to comment directly on war. Therefore, they prefer artistic ways to express themselves.
I Free You Palestine and Lullaby were two poems by Atefe Sadat Darbandi, which were later turned into a video clip. The clips have been screened on Press TV and welcomed by the audience.
I was feeling sad when seeing the photos of the Palestinian kids who were suffering in conflicts, so I wrote an English poem called Lullaby for these kids. It is a story of the parents who are singing lullaby for their babies, asking them to keep calm because all these difficulties may pass. A colleague of mine composed its music and sang the song. Then we turned it into a video clip to be aired on TV.
The issue of Palestine is one of the major topics these days when deals are being formed between some Arab states and Israel to normalize ties. But artists from these countries oppose such relations.
Resistance art reflects how the Palestinians suffered under occupation for over 50 years. Art is a great way of expression and helps the artists to show their first-hand experiences. Humana Abedi, Tehran.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warn that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, The Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they urge both the Afghan government and the Taliban to set aside their differences and use the Afghan peace process as a great opportunity to put an end to the decades-long misery of the war-weary nation.
Unfortunately, we have gained nothing from peace summits over the past 2 years. Instead, war in the country has intensified. I think it is high time that both sides forgot about military options, set aside their differences, and launched meaningful negotiations to end the war here.
Top Afghan security officials say they stand ready to safeguard the nation in case the Taliban continue to insist on saying no to negotiations.
According to the head of Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security, the Taliban is now weaker than ever due to alleged rifts between the militant group's main leadership in Quetta Shura and its offshoot in Pakistan's Peshawar. This is thought to be a major stumbling block if the militants seek to put up a fight against some 300,000 Afghan security and defense forces after the withdrawal of nearly 10,000 foreign troops from Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Indian-administered Kashmir has seen a surge in coronavirus cases in times with the rest of the country. The pandemic was almost brought under control in February in the region, but within weeks, the numbers have swollen again to around 18,000 positive cases. Healthcare experts equally blame Kashmir's administration and locals for the spike. Despite the risks, the administration in Kashmir allowed and organized spring festivals. They were attended by thousands without following precautions, leading to a resurge in coronavirus cases. And to worsen things, tourists' inflow to Kashmir went unchecked. Kashmir has hardly witnessed normalcy since August 2019, when India unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomous status. Now, amid the second wave of the pandemic, fresh tensions are expected as new lockdowns would collapse the region's economy. Farooq Ahmed Shah, a hotelier, is discussing the ongoing situation with his staff. He's worried, but not for himself.
We have witnessed back-to-back lockdowns. Unfortunately, we do hiring every year, but with no time, we have to lay off. I'm not much worried about my business. But for these young men who have no source of daily income or savings that can sustain them in tough times, Kashmir's economy has always been suffering. But since 2019, Kashmir is witnessing horrible times and people are forced into poverty.
Kashmir's economy is dependent on tourism and agriculture. This year, the region witnessed year-long bookings in advance. However, the new wave of the pandemic in India has triggered panic and cancellations.
The pandemic since 2020 has 100% affected us, but you know, from November, the tourism started reviving, and December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed, if not 100, but 80% for sure. So since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kick-started the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trial stage, you have to go for more, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 billion doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V. Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure. Last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met, while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment. And that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation, anything that we can do to fix the foundational level. Sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
We don't get it!
The Mujahideen Brigades held a military drill to show its readiness in fight against Israeli forces. The drill, named Effective Promise, was held in several parts of the enclave, simulating many defensive combat scenarios on the ground and sea. The drill also sent a clear message to the Zionist regime that the resistance will fight back the crimes committed against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds in light of the recent clashes in the Holy City.
This drill serves as a clear message to Israel that the resistance front is ready to face any aggression. This is also a message of support to our sons in Jerusalem al-Quds, who are fighting the Zionists with all their strength.
Attending the establishment anniversary of Mujahideen Brigades, leaders of Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, expressed their support to Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Jerusalem is our red line, and the Israeli regime will be held accountable for the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine, and we stand in solidarity with our sons in Jerusalem and will fight alongside them at all costs.
We are all united in the face of the Israeli regime. This is a national battle, and we are all united in protecting Jerusalem al-Quds against the Zionists. The battle is not only in Jerusalem. It's underway in every part of Palestine, and we are ready to sacrifice our lives for Palestine.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured in clashes at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting "Death to Arabs" in their rally in the center of the occupied city.
The resistance here showed it won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes committed against the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem al-Quds, vowing to defend the Palestinian rights at all costs. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions that parents have in regards to the Islamic upbringing of their children. the answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Rishahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. It's always nice to have you here, Brother Miqdad. Thank you very much for being with us.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So we have a particular question today that I think a lot of parents might experience. It goes that my six-year-old child has to have a lot of time on his own. He doesn't like spending time with his friends too much. But he has a lot of toy soldiers that he pretends are his friends, and he plays all these social games with them. This worries me. There's a particular tone in this question. The parent